important for us to stay on time because capital investment will be taking over this pool at 5:30 promptly. We will start. Senator Cooley has a couple of bills first.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. You know, Senate File 1698 is a bill that looks at the possibility of giving some energy grants primarily to public schools, but, you know, has some other local governmental units that might be a possibility included in it. But Bob Ryan from Bird Island is with me today and has a little PowerPoint that he wants to give you that, you know, kind of outlines briefly a company that deals with some biomass products that might be an option for anything that could be funded. I understand that, you know, money is tight this year and the possibility of passing things with an appropriation is not real high, but I think it's worth taking a look at, Madam Chair. Pardon? Well, at the end, it just says that there is an appropriation from the general fund to the Commissioner of Commerce, and that's why I say that I'm not sure that the likelihood is real high this year, but I still think it's worth a few minutes of our time.
Madam Chair, my name is Robert Ryan. I'm the CEO of Sunrise Agri-Fuels out of Bird Island, Minnesota, and we are a biomass manufacturing and development company. We basically are a community-based project that has done an extensive amount of work in developing different formulas with the gracious help of AURI, and I want to recognize them as heavily as possible before this committee and the great work that they have done for the state of Minnesota and our industry. Sunrise Agri-Fuels manufactured and produced more biomass solid fuels in 2006 and 7 heating seasons than any other company in the state of Minnesota. We developed those products out of agro-residues and forest biomass products. We intend to build out facilities within our area to be able to consume these residues from this agro-bio growth and look at expanding that model in a community development type model across the state. What we provide in this process is local manufacturing jobs. We're creating market and sales positions for a new field of a fuel resource. We provide jobs, full-time jobs, along with seasonal jobs in transportation and handling of raw fuel materials. We will need distribution networks, boiler and furnace installation companies, and sales and services. And we will add an additional income to farmers selling plant stover at no additional cost to them as far as production costs. What Sunrise Agri-Fuels does is takes the residues, as you see on the screen, of not the cereal grains but the byproduct of the plant life, and combine them in different types of formulas to create thermal-based fuel to be consumed in residential and commercial applications. As I said, we add revenue without any input cost to the farmer. As you see in this slide, our major ingredient for the products that we build in our facility is soybean stover, which as we remove from the fields, the farmers' fields, we are actually removing only $1.73 of fertility value. Within a 30-mile radius of our plant design, they generate 300,000 tons of fuel based on only less than 40% of the stover removed from the field itself. So we are very, very low impact in the development and the build out of the soil condition within the stover itself. As you see, that one ton of that straw is equal to 176 gallons of LP gas. Now, that's equal to 52 million gallons of LP gas, or an industry of 100 over $104 million worth of revenue within a 30-mile circle of a plant. That's an extreme financial impact to the to a community of our size. What we're going to do this, why we want to do this, is I come from a community development background. I firmly believe in trying to repopulate and rebuild rural Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota, in general. We want to do this in a manner to be able to buy down costs for public buildings and school systems, along with residential facilities. Our fuel process fits in the best into small and medium-sized commercial facilities, along with livestock, poultry, and greenhouse facilities. Now, renewable energy in the state of Minnesota has done a phenomenal job here. I need to commend you and your predecessors in the process. As you see on this particular chart, transportation across this nation in the energy sector itself is approximately 28% of the total energy needed is expended in transportation costs. Industry, we've done a good job in wind and geothermal is starting to really come to life in our nation, and that consists of 33%. The residential and the commercial piece of the pie, we really haven't met yet. And that's where our industry, I think, can fill that gap. We'll be looking at approximately 38% of the rest of the energy requirements can be filled by these types of systems. Now, look, I took a cost analysis. This was based on a CenterPoint Energy's information presented, I believe it was on the 17th of January of this year. As you can see, the upper three categories of the fossil-based fuels products that were on this chart, and I'm saying electricity is fossil-based because there is a considerable amount of it that is produced by fossil-based fuels. We can see we're in the 20s to the mid-$20 per million BTUs in cost per thermal unit. You look at natural gas is much cheaper, much more competitive in the nature of the chart. But when you look at the bottom, where you look at biomass products, you're looking at a much, much lower price for these fuels, and especially as we relate to LP gas and fuel oil. The past 10-year trends, we saw fuel oil costs, if you like, take per-year increments and percentages, we saw over the last 10 years 338% increase in fuel oil cost, 364% in propane, and 118% in natural gas. The only solid fuels that I can compare it to with this to this committee and have numbers I can back up comes from the wood pellet industry. They've only increased 38% over that same period of time. What we're looking at here is the school systems is what my bill here would be presented in general for is to try to take communities that are having problems in keeping their costs down for their school systems to be able to provide an alternative process to fuel oil and LP, and even in the natural gas, you can see there's a considerable savings in fuel costs. What we looked at in the slide before is we're looking at multiple 100% increases. Here we're comparing natural gas costs for our school district where I live, looking at increases based on 20% increase over a 10-year period of time, and a 10% increase in biomass cost over a 10-year period of time. In those results, we have a possible savings of over $500,000 over 10 years in the fuel output cost for those school districts. That's a considerable number of teachers to employ or programs to within the school systems to continue. This particular slide depicts the next one here. What's going on here? I can't move for some reason or another. We're locked up. There we go. Next one. This is the fuel oil system in Franklin, Minnesota. In this particular scenario, we're looking at the actual cost for 2006 and 2007. Using those same projections, expanding over a 20% increase instead of a 10%, and looking at a 10% or 20% increase in biomass costs, we're still saving them over $500,000 in 10 years. So I think this is a very good opportunity for school systems to look at systems as you see in front of you now. Now, this is a European system that actually presents and burns much like a traditional natural gas or fuel oil system. It's a horizontal combustion system that burns at 92% thermal efficiency. Our company, I've been very honored to be a part of a group of European and U.S. Manufacturers and academics that have been working on a process called the IREDI process, the International Renewable Energy Technology Institute, which just midnight last night we finished up our tours of the three states that were the finalists in this application process. Minnesota, I'm proud to say, was one of those three states out of 16 that applied. Georgia was the second, and New York was the third. We will be making a decision who will receive that institute by the end of March. What this institute does is it provides for an ability to be able to retrofit the technology that I just showed you to be able to utilize U.S. standards in thermal technology, in EPA standards, local standards, and electronic standards to be able to retrofit those systems to bring them into the U.S. The next category is AFAB USA. That's the manufacturing or the ability to put these things into a distribution market for consumers to receive these products into the U.S. That particular process will be done through agreements between companies here in Minnesota and across the nation in being able to take European technology and making it available to U.S. manufacturers to get in our distribution network. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll yield for any questions that may be. The one that you looked at back three slides, there are none of that particular operation in the United States. We do have the ability to use the coal technology, the stoker-based facilities, and be able to move those into these systems now. This international, the IREDI process is looking at a very fast track and looking at bringing product into the U.S. and into Minnesota by the heating season of 2010. So we are not far off from being able to bring that technology into the U.S.
So these grants then would be for the school systems to be able to purchase?
Madam Chair, no, the intention of the grant would be to allow them to study and do the recommendations for the school systems and to be able to put together a competitive bid process to be able to retrofit and change into a more cost-effective fuel strategy.
Madam Chair, the handout that you have, we do not have that handout. We do. Could you guide me to where to find it? None of us here could find it.
It's about the fifth.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
What I would say that the requirements of purchasing and installing is a certain amount of bid spec needs to be put together, and to get to a position to actually purchase the unit, we may need to have a amendment to the process.
Oh, it actually says that in this bill, though.
Madam Chair, could you just briefly go over the physical aspects of doing this? I mean, would it be enclosed in a building within the school, or would it be – because you'd be handling big bales of this material, wouldn't you? Or?
No, it would not. The process of how this works is the systems themselves, as you can see in this particular slide, behind that boiler, that That boiler is a 2 million BTU system. Behind it is holding tanks that hold solid-based fuels that are 20 to 25 ton per. So there's 50 ton of material in there that will run 3 to 5 months. So the process, the baled material has been densified in a product that weighs approximately 40 pounds per cubic foot. So it becomes a flowable material that is able to pass through these auger systems and into the lead head of the combustion system itself. Now, if you were going to do that on a traditional grate-type boiler, it would be the same way. It would be fed into a system where the fuel would be laid on the bed of the burner itself and feed through, much like coal would, in a solid form. So our company takes that bale and condenses it into about 300 times less its volume per cubic foot.
Madam Chair and guest, is this a flexible fuel furnace? Is there some other fuels that it also can use? It can use coal, for instance.
This particular unit can burn wood pellets. It could burn biomass pellets. It can burn barley. It can burn corn. It could burn Solex. It can burn any type of flowable fuel. It cannot burn traditional coal, which I don't think we want to deal with anyway. Our company is, of course, looking at an alternative to carbon-based fuels.
And one follow-up. Are there any of these in the U.S.?
Are there any of this particular model?
Correct.
There are none. Not as of yet. But as I say, we could, in our process, we need to start evaluating systems so that when they are available, and we can move them into an ability for schools to be prepped and ready to accept these systems.
Well, we should probably change that date to the current year, Madam Chair.
So Mr. Fuller's been looking at an amendment.
Madam Chair, members, it's a little difficult because the whole bill is designed to fund the purchase and installations. But here's my, so if it is intended to fund the, I think what's called is the energy project study, here's my suggestion. On line 21, delete purchasing and installing and insert an energy project study related to the purchase and installation of a heating unit. So it would read, subject to the availability of funds, the commissioner shall approve grants to a K-12 public school or a county, city, town, or any other political subdivision for the cost of an energy project study related to the purchase and installation of a heating unit designed to burn biomass. Okay. And then on line 23, we would delete purchase after July 1st, 2007, because we're no longer talking about a purchase. So it would read, a grant may be provided under the section only for a heating unit that is listed by underwriter's laboratory. Well, I'll take that back. We have to take out that whole sentence because we're not talking about any particular. I mean, if we are in fact talking about the study, the unit is irrelevant and it's premature. So we take out the sentence that starts on line 22, 23, and ends on line 24. Then the next sentence, it would read just, a grant may not exceed, then we would delete the lesser of 25% of the total cost of purchasing and installing an eligible heating unit, or, and leave in so that a grant may not exceed $50,000. since we're no longer talking about the purchasing. And then I've gotten down to line 2.9, where we're referring to an application for a grant. However, it talks about whether or not the information energy project study are appropriate, but we're funding the study. So at this point, I guess I would remove that clause. Are we moving this bill out to somewhere? It's a little awkward, you know, the way it exists now, because it was drawn to accommodate a purchase of something, and now we're doing something else. So I guess I would say less is better. I would suggest that you take out everything after commissioner on 2.6. So it would read, application for a grant under this section must be made by an eligible applicant to the commissioner on a form that I would insert prescribed by the commissioner. I would delete the rest of that line and delete everything down to 2.15. And there are two other points that are in, let me just see if it talks about purchase anywhere else. People are welcome to help out.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I wasn't aware before Mr. Ryan mentioned it that it was for anything other than the bill listed.
I'm wondering if we couldn't lay this over, we could bring it up at another meeting, if you'd be willing to do the work on it and then come back.
Sure. That'd be fine, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 2749 has delete everything amendment. You know, it's the A08 amendment that should be in your packets, members. Amendment was drafted by Mr. Bowl from the department, and he's here if you'd like him to comment on that. I think the changes would accomplish the same objective, Madam Chair. So I think it's a good amendment, and I think it would do the things that we intended to do with the original bill.
Make that an offer.
Senator Sharon offers to delete the A08 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, that's
your chance to say
adopted.
There.
Would you like to have Mr. Bowen comment?
Yeah, I think that would be helpful, Madam Chair. On the bill as amended now, I know that the section listed under subdivisions 3, starting on 1.27, that expires June 30th of this year. So I don't know. You know, it seems like a pretty short time frame, Madam Chair, to do anything with this. So I guess I'd look to Mr. Bull for a suggestion on that as well.
Madam Chairman.
Yes. Senator.
Would the good Senator Kubley, could you take maybe a 2 or 3 minutes and tell us what this is all about before we get into the details? I mean, I honestly have not read this.
All right. Well,
I'm not alone.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, it's an attempt to ask an entity now, not the state, but an entity that would help small developers of wind energy systems gain access to the current market for turbines. You know, I think most manufacturers, it doesn't seem to me that they'll even listen to you if you want to buy, you know, less than, say, 20 megawatts or whatever. So it's an attempt to find a place that can aggregate the number of megawatts that are required before the turbine manufacturer will listen to you to allow those small want-to-be producers to move into the arena that they would like to, produce a little electricity in that would be helpful in gaining them access to the turbine market that they currently do not have access to.
Madam Chair, I'm Mike Bull. I'm with the Minnesota Office for Energy Security at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The last session, you may recall that Senator Anderson and Representative Kate Knuth had a bill to create a rural wind technical assistance program and set up a grant system to identify the nonprofit that would provide the technical assistance to communities that want to develop wind projects, from the contracting to working with utilities to working amongst themselves to create the right mechanisms to do that. And part of that responsibility was to work on turbine purchases as well. The we've gone through the process and identified the grantee, which is the Southwest Initiative Foundation, working with a number of experienced wind developers to provide technical assistance to communities. And so what we're asking them to do in the context of that work, that's the entity that's referred to here, is to provide this specific turbine aggregation program as well, so that while they're working with those communities can pool their turbine purchases dollars together and get a better bang for their buck when they go to buy those very expensive wind turbines.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
So I'm still catching up. So if I, you know, I can't even envision this. If I were to want to buy three wind turbines personally, it would be difficult for me to do that? I mean, to place an order with a turbine company?
Well, Madam
Chair,
wouldn't
even get on their list?
And Senator Senjum, I mean, you may be able to get on the list, but it depends on how long you're willing to wait. But I can't imagine with your resources, Senator Senjum, that you couldn't afford 20 more than that. But,
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I could afford the door latch and bottom of the turbine.
Well, it is fairly expensive to get into today, Madam Chair and Mr. Senjum, or Senator Senjum. But I was just trying to give you a bit of a hard time here, But anyway, I do think that it is difficult for people ordering a small number of turbines. And, you know, it's just an attempt to get that level up to the point where, you know, that they'd be willing to listen to you and put you on a little faster track than you would be if you would be ordering, you know, less than so many megawatts.
Madam Chair, just to reiterate that point, this is the one that being able to the turbine availability, being able to purchase turbines, is one of the two biggest barriers to wind development for community wind development. And so the idea would be to try to help get over that hump a little bit by aggregating the purchases together, reduce the cost, get the attention of the wind manufacturer, the turbine manufacturers a little better, and move the ball forward for those projects.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not prepared very well here either. Could you explain to me, it says the annual cost of the program up to blank are assessed under Section 21C. Could you help me understand how this is being paid for?
She's talking about this language.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the proposal is to assess the cost of the program through ratepayers. up to a fairly small amount. We haven't quite worked out with the Southwest Initiative Foundation what that cost would be, but I think the next stop would be the Finance Committee where we would fill in that blank.
And Senator Kubley, since this authorization is expiring soon, we're looking at an amendment that would just make an appropriation, if you're okay with that. Mr. Bull?
Madam Chair, the whatever awkwardness in the amendment is my fault.
Okay.
Which wouldn't be surprising to anyone, I don't.
Mr. Fuller is going to read an amendment, okay.
Madam Chair, members, the language on page 1, line 27, page 1, line 29 would be deleted for a couple of reasons. One is that the talks about annual costs, and this mechanism expires in June. Second of all, there may be some issue about whether it's appropriate to assess the cost of this program in the manner suggested, and rather just put in a Section 2 appropriation, and with the thought that this allows further work on it. A blank appropriation, dollar blank, is appropriated from the general fund to the Commission of Commerce in fiscal year 2009 for the purpose of making a grant to the entity described in Section 1 for the purposes of Section 1.
Senator Kubley, does that
Well, again, Madam Chair, I guess, I'm not sure about the availability of appropriations from the general fund, but if that is less problematic, we could probably proceed with that at this point and see where it goes in the other chamber, too.
And Senator Kubley, you could come up with an amendment to change it when it gets into finance.
Sure.
Also, but this at least would
move it out of this
allow
committee,
us to
sure.
move it on.
Yeah, that'd be fine, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions or comments? Senator Sharon, would you move
the
amendment? Okay. Are there questions or comments about the amendment? Then all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
The purpose of the program is say it shall do something. Get rid of that thing. We don't have to do it. But then there's two policy issues. What is this one? What's a minimal framework?
Okay.
And what is coordinated?
Senator Kubley, in the future, would you have your bills drafted through Mr. Fuller?
All right.
And he can help you with some of the technical stuff.
Okay.
And there are some technical problems with this, but he can help you to get it ready for the next body if you would care to meet with him.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Is there somebody willing to move the amended bill?
I thought Senator Sharon did.
Pardon?
The amendment.
She did that.
I'll move it.
Okay. Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2749 is amended, be recommended to pass, and re-referred to state and local government operations first.
All right.
Okay. Any questions? Any comments?
How are you getting along?
All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? And motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
For all their ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Everyone's got all the slides for your for the people that are going to testify in support of your bill.
Okay. Can you work on that while we are testifying, do you think? We have a really short time frame.
All set.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brettner-Solon.
I have Senate File 2706, and this is known as the Sustainable Buildings 2030 proposal, and it's based upon a national initiative called the Architecture 2030 Challenge. And they're going to try to set up some slides while I'm offering my testimony here, introducing the bill, and there are a series of testifiers afterwards. This concept has wide support by architects, planners, professional organizations, and other states around the country. By accepting the Architecture 2030 Challenge, new buildings are to immediately be designed to consume 50% less carbon-based energy than the average existing building. Future buildings would realize further reductions based upon the following schedule: 60% in 2010, 70% in 2015, 80% in 2020, 90% in 2025. And these standards are ever increasing such that by 2030, the efficiency of new buildings would be essentially carbon neutral. The genesis of the idea for Minnesota came from the Residential, Commercial, and Industrial Technical Work Group, or the RCI TWIG, of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. While the work group recognized the importance of continually strengthening Minnesota's energy codes, they also recognized that changing codes is a slow process. The idea from the work group is to leapfrog ahead of the codes by quickly implementing Architecture 2030 through capacity building and incentives and by mandating its use in new state-owned buildings. This approach will encourage design innovation that the code simply could not achieve. As we prove the effectiveness of Sustainable Building 2030, many of its provisions can be used to strengthen codes. The RCI TWIG strongly supports this concept, provided the standards are developed for the unique needs and to be cost-effective for Minnesota buildings. Okay. Under this legislation, Sustainable Building 2030 would be a voluntary standard for all private sector buildings. The implementation standards would be facilitated by utility programs and incentives, and the standards would be mandatory only for state-bonded buildings. Once the standards are fully developed, they would replace the energy requirements in the sustainable design guidelines that are currently used for state-bonded buildings. Mr. Chair, I have the A4 delete all amendment that I would like to offer before I explain the bill.
Senator Prettner-Solon moves the A4 delete all amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Is there any discussion on that? All those in favor say aye.
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 Motion is adopted. Prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Section 1 modifies the existing sustainable building guidelines to match the new 2030 standards. These standards will be developed through a process I will describe later in the bill. And by doing this, we will have guidelines for state-bonded buildings that are as green as current technology makes available and are automatically improved over time as technologies and building techniques are developed. Section 2 provides funding for development and ongoing refinement of the standards. This is not additional state funding. The bill simply directs that up to $500,000 of the $3.6 million annually assessed to the utilities for research grants in the Utility Conservation Improvement Program may be used for this purpose. The majority of the research funds will still focus on existing buildings and facilities. This bill would ensure that research focused on new buildings would be directed toward meeting the most aggressive energy efficiency standards possible. The Office of Energy Security would provide direct oversight of these funds, just as they would do with any other SIP research project. Section 3, Subdivision 9A, defines the purpose of establishing these standards. We are simply attempting to move as quickly as possible to find practical techniques for minimizing energy use and carbon emissions. Subdivision 9B directs the Commissioner of Commerce to contract with the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota to manage all aspects of developing these standards. It requires them to work in consultation with the utilities and experts in building design construction. This is a process similar to that used to develop the sustainable building guidelines that are currently in use. This process worked very well and allowed for extensive involvement by key stakeholders in developing the standards. Subdivision 9C provides further direction that the standards are to be based upon energy use and carbon emissions per square foot of building use or building area. The standards are to be updated every 3 to 5 years with cost-effective measures to reduce carbon-based energy use by the percentages that were mentioned before. Cost-effectiveness will be determined by the Center for Sustainable Building Research with input from the utility industry and the building industry, with oversight by the Department of Energy Security. The department has decades of experience with cost-effectiveness through the SIP program. Subdivision 9D limits funding for administration of the contract to $150,000 annually. The balance of the funds is to be subcontracted for qualified professional services to ensure the effectiveness of the recommended energy efficiency standards. Subdivision 9E directs the department to require that all utilities offer SIP programs that are expressly targeted to meet the 2030 standards. Many utilities already have programs to encourage energy-efficient new construction. This direction would ensure that those programs are modified and improved to help build the most energy-efficient buildings possible. This will be a very important area for utilities to capture additional savings that can be counted toward their 1.5% savings goal. Effective and innovative energy efficiency measures will be essential for the success of this concept. Subdivision 9F requires the commissioner to report to the legislature every 3 years on the cost-effectiveness of the program, progress on meeting the goals, and to give recommendations on whether to continue the program. And Mr. Chair and committee members, this concludes the summary of the Delete All Amendment. I have with me Sheldon Strum from the Center for Energy and Environment, who is a member of the MCAG RCI TWIG that formulated this proposal. There are also, I know, a number of others that wish to testify. And when the testimony is complete, I'm willing to stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Prettner-Solin. Mr. Strum, if you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee.
Sure. Welcome. Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Sheldon Strum. I run an organization called the Center for Energy and Environment. We've been doing energy efficiency work and a little bit of renewable energy work and some energy policy work for over 25 years. Most of our experience has been in existing buildings. We don't have a lot of expertise in large commercial buildings, but a lot of people that are going to testify here today do have that expertise. As the senator mentioned, I was on this residential, commercial, industrial technical work group, and one of the ideas that was suggested was this idea that we're calling Sustainable Building 2030. And I just thought, after all my years of doing these things, that it was such a great idea because it focused on the performance of these buildings and said, let's make these buildings as good as we possibly can. A lot of the other standards that are out there give people scores for being a LEED building or another type of green building, and that's fine. But what really attracted me to this issue is that it was so quantifiable and it was so results-oriented, and it seemed to me a natural fit to combine this with the utility initiative that was passed by the legislature last year to have these very aggressive goals. So what this bill does, as the senator said, is that it spends a little bit of money to develop these guidelines and make sure that they're easily implemented, and it changes some of the state guidelines for sustainable buildings, but probably most importantly, it engages the utilities in the process of trying to help build the best buildings possible. This is all governed by cost effectiveness, but as you'll hear from some of the other presenters who have a lot of experience in commercial buildings, there is a lot of potential for cost effective innovations in new buildings. And as energy prices increase, if we have carbon taxes on fuels, and as technologies change, we're hopeful that we can meet these very aggressive goals.
Senator Prettner-Solin, did you want to wait and have all the presenters come forward and then take questions, or do we want to take questions of each of the testifiers? How did you want to handle that?
It's your wish.
Are there any
Mr.
questions
Chair.
From members, from Mr. Strom? Okay, thank you. Yeah. We have up Mr. John Carmody. And welcome to the committee, and please again identify yourself for the record.
Would you rather sit here?
This is fine. This is fine. I thought maybe I'd have Sheldon here, but in case we needed to answer some technical questions. You're right behind me.
He's right behind
you. Okay, hello. My name is John Carmody. I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. I was also involved in the RCI technical working group that was part of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. Our center at the university was responsible for leading the team to develop the current Minnesota sustainable building guidelines that are used on all bonded projects in Minnesota. That was became effective in 2004. I think that legislation was passed in 2001 or 2002. Which requires 30% energy savings on all buildings. We now track and implement that. We assist state agencies and, in some cases, local governments with making their buildings more sustainable and following various guidelines and standards. It's interesting to note that since 2004, there have been 50 state-funded projects that have gone through that program at an estimated 3.7 million square feet. And they have, we estimate they're saving $1,670,000 a year in energy costs and 47,000 tons of CO2 per year. This bill we're talking about here builds on that. And what I'd like to do in my brief time up here is just give you a little bit of background about buildings and green buildings and then let the other speakers talk more specifically about energy savings and how this can be applied. As many of you know, buildings are one of the big contributors to energy use and global warming. 65% of the total electricity use occurs in buildings. 36% of primary energy use is in buildings. But if you include all of the materials and all the construction processes that go into buildings, you can say that 48%, nearly half of all energy, is associated with buildings. And, of course, the carbon emissions that come with that. In addition, sustainable design refers to not just energy and carbon, but, of course, water, waste, material resources, and so forth, and it has huge impacts in all those areas. In the last 5 years, I'd say there's been an explosion of activity. You could call it almost a revolution in the design professions and the awareness of how much improvement we could make in the building stock. This slide is just showing four different examples of sustainable guidelines or rating systems. Most people may have heard of the LEED system, where you get points and then you get a silver or gold or a platinum rating level, which is definitely good, and it's raised market awareness and so forth, but it doesn't necessarily mean you get to a certain level of energy savings or carbon emissions. The others there include at the bottom the Minnesota guidelines, which is one of the earliest regional examples of this. The Minnesota guidelines are unique in a way because they do prescribe that you must get a certain level of energy savings. So in a sense, I think they're ahead of the pack. In the residential sector, we have a whole different set of guidelines. There's LEED, but predominant in Minnesota is a Green Communities program required on the affordable housing projects now that come through MHFA, as well as the Minnesota Green Star developed in the private sector by the Twin Cities Builders Association. And there's other national guidelines as well. So finally, at the development scale, or what you might think of as the neighborhood scale, there's now just emerging guidelines that apply to not just an individual building, but a neighborhood where we can talk about transit and land use issues, as well as district energy and so forth. So this array of guidelines shows there's huge interest. It shows that there's many people out there trying to do the right thing, but it also reflects a certain amount of confusion. And I think one of the biggest problems, as Sheldon alluded to, is the lack of clear targets to meet the performance goals that we really need to meet. If we're really going to get to the level of carbon emission reduction by 2030, we can't just let these various voluntary and somewhat loose guidelines do the job. So this slide shows Architecture 2030, which is a national initiative that expresses the idea of moving in these five-year increments so that as we on that, if we do business as usual, we're going to continue to increase our energy use in the building sector. If we meet the targets that we're talking about here, we actually can reverse this trend and bring it down. So just in summary, there's a diverse set of guidelines and rating systems that are continually evolving in this green building or sustainable or energy efficiency field. They're quickly being adopted by states and cities as a basis for code standards and incentives. So things that were voluntary a few years ago are becoming requirements. There's also a movement away from these kind of simple point-based systems to focusing on real performance outcomes like carbon and energy. And that's what this bill is about. There's also more life cycle assessment of materials, a sort of deeper understanding of the real impacts of things we do. And finally, people tracking the actual performance of buildings, not just designing them, assuming they're going to work, but actually track them. And that'll be a big part of this activity as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
These are all great suggestions, but I've talked to some of the presidents of, like, Minsku facilities in my area, and they said whenever they've come forward with, like, a geothermal proposal or something like that, then their allocation from the bonding bill is less, and so that's the first thing that gets whacked off the plan. So I support all this stuff, but I'm trying to figure out, and maybe you'll have the money later, but I'm trying to figure out where the funding's going to come or how we're going to not keep cutting those good plans out of the picture.
You're speaking of the funding to do the necessary improvements to have the higher performance building. Well, there is that disconnect in the public sector between the capital costs, which are fixed, and the operating costs. I mean, it usually makes great sense in terms of payback. Some of these things cost very little more and have very short paybacks. The next speaker is actually going to address that in detail. They've looked at many, many buildings, and he can give you more detailed information on that. But how we deal with that in the public sector is a question. In the private sector, actually, I think incentives from the utility money to meet the targets that the utilities need to meet anyway are likely to be there. There are some creative ideas. I know they've used at the University of Minnesota to get over that obstacle. So it's a great point. These goals, though, are very doable. These aren't real pie in the sky. You're going to see buildings that have already been built that meet them today, and we should be able to meet them with, especially with increasing energy prices that we anticipate in the future and technology development.
Senator Prettner-Solden?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, and for that very purpose, a portion of the bill was heard in Senator Anderson's Environment Budget Committee. So for the purpose of moving it on to capital investment, so it becomes a policy that will be understood as capital improvement or capital investment projects are coming forward. And I think it's really important that we start thinking differently about our buildings. And while there may be some upfront costs, as Mr. Carmody was saying, the recapture period is short, and then we will continue to have energy savings and cost savings also along the way.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just further on this discussion, Senator Olsen, I'm glad you brought that up as well, because I've been thinking about this too. How can we get these agencies to put that upfront money in? And I had some conversations with the Department of Administration about that and asking them, why aren't agencies trying to do this already, even though we've had laws on the books that suggest that they should consider you know, not just efficiency, but they should consider solar or geothermal, other ways to reduce their energy demand on with on-site projects. And we talked about whether there should be a separate pot of money set aside to try to help with those upfront costs and financed by user finance bonds. And anyway, we never could make it work. I mean, I tried to put together a bill, and I kept running into all these roadblocks about why we can't do it. And so it's frustrating, but, I mean, I think you're right. You're definitely on the right track, Senator Solon here. I mean, trying to put more requirements up front so that they're incorporated in the pre-design process is important. But I think it will take more than that to make sure that when we fund, when we make those final decisions, that we do take into account long-term savings. It's just not, it's not happening very much in the current bonding cycle just because of the nature of too many projects and not enough money. And so we do end up losing that extra investment that it would take to go the extra mile. So I'm not quite sure how we're going to make that happen, and I hope this will help us get there. I think it's going to take more efforts from all of us in our bonding requests.
Senator Dibble had a question.
Oh, I was just also responding to Senator Olstein. Next bill, we're going to talk a little bit about some mechanisms for local units of government to access some financing, and also in the bonding bill, that's more designed for those that have more of a short-term payoff. And in the bonding bill, and I don't know if we're going to make it or not, some proposals for locals to access some assistance with the incremental costs for these longer-term sort of payoff building improvements.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chairman Dahl. I'm just curious, these improvements, is there a way of quantifying what the additional cost would be to a public project? Is that something that is quantifiable so that we know what we're doing?
Actually, I think the next three speakers will give you a lot of information about that with some case studies.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Carmody.
Senator Dahl.
Oh,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you very much. I'm just here pondering and looking at your title and what you do. Do you get involved at all about, you know, advising on uniform building codes? It just, I don't know, I just express my own feelings. It seems to me that, you know, the building codes come through here every year or two, and we just adopt them almost on a consent agenda basis, and we never look at them from the standpoint of energy or energy savings, and, you know, maybe others along the way do, but do you have your fingers in that at all?
Yes and no. Okay. I'm on national standards committees for green building standards and so forth. I don't personally get involved in the state code, but I'm well aware that we have a new, very efficient state code moving through the process currently.
And, Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum.
Do you have you feel pretty good about the fact that that's going to take us to a different level in terms of energy savings?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I also believe that this bill does require that the building codes be updated on a regular basis based on the improvements that we're able to make as we move forward with this bill.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carmody, on that point that you were talking about before with respect to the Uniform Building Code, Is there an effort to make the changes that, you know, we initiated a no indoor smoking last year, and so that would make a difference on the number of air changes that ASHRAE would require? Mm-hmm. Is that being introduced in the building code?
As I understand it is. I don't want to pretend I'm an expert at those kind of details, but yes, that is the current standard. It's, you know, becoming much more efficient, and that's part of why it is.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Prentice Solon.
If we could hear from some of the other speakers, they might be able to provide more detail, too. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Carmody. And I guess we'll bring up John White and Rick Carter, whichever the is appropriate to come up next. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is John White. I'm the founder of a company called the White Group. I'm going to bring us up briefly here.
just eat.
I founded the company 31 years ago here in Minnesota, specifically to do energy and environmental consulting in the building community. Since we started counting, we didn't count for a few years because we weren't sure we were going to make it. But we've done 583 new buildings, consulted on new buildings in the United States with 120 million square feet of building construction that we've consulted on. We're also in the process of benchmarking over 5,000 Minnesota buildings in terms of their existing energy use and ways in which we might be able to improve that. Our records show that our work has reduced air pollution by about 604 kilotons a year, and we've saved the clients that we've worked with about $58 million a year annually in energy costs. One of the key ingredients of that of our work has been working with Xcel and managing their commercial SIP program for the last number of years. There's questions about funding and so on. Obviously, the utilities provide incentives to private industry to build a better building and save some energy, which is what they've been directed to do by the state. In preparing for the testimony on this bill, we look back to projects that we've consulted on since 2000. We have about 441 of those projects represented here. That's about 59 million square feet, and the energy savings range are wild. They're 2% to 78%. The average 33%. They've been averaging 33% for longer than I'm happy with, but that's $26 million in energy cost savings with an average payback of 2.5 years. Quite, if only I could do that in the market. Now, what about the 2030 bill? The 2030 goals are a significant challenge. Energy use has gone along declining modestly since 1978, when I started in the business, we're looking at it dropping precipitously after today. On the other hand, I firmly believe, and I believe we can prove, that energy conservation is a proven strategy. It must be achieved by practical means. There are some very impractical ways to save energy in buildings, and that is not cost effective. These goals are challenging, we believe, but we believe they're achievable. In looking back at those buildings we've done since 2000, we found that 25 of those buildings met the standards for 2020 already. That's about 1.6 million square feet of buildings, $1.2 million saved annually, and an 18% return on investment on average. So that's about closer to a 5-year payback than a 2.5-year payback, but it wasn't a huge leap to get to 60% energy savings on average. Some of these buildings did remarkably well, quite a bit better. I've got just three examples that I'd like to bring your attention to. Starting back in 1978, one of the first buildings I ever worked on was in Wells, Minnesota, the Security State Bank. Pat Hart was the owner of the bank, decided he just wanted to build a building that wouldn't use all this much energy. He was a banker. He wanted to save his money. And that building was designed to use about a third of the energy of its contemporaries. When we went back and visited it in 2000, it was still using about a third, a little over a third, about 38% of the energy of its contemporaries. And the energy increase had come from people using the building as a community center so much that the lights were on more than they had anticipated. We consulted closely on a project for the Iowa Association of Municipal Utilities back in 2000. They wanted to lead their customers and show them how a building could be built practically. That building uses 32% of the energy of its peers during that period of time, and it was built for an increased construction budget of about 2%. It's got a 38% return on investment. And then the Science House right here in St. Paul, we were the energy consultants on that project in 2002. The project is shown as zero. In fact, that building produces energy. It produces about 35% more energy in the course of a year than it consumes. This is done from some four very simple basic steps. The first thing you do is you minimize the load of the building. You don't design a building to use any more energy than it absolutely has to. Then supply that energy efficiently. Supply your lighting, your heating, your cooling as efficiently as you can. use renewable energy sources as much as possible, and to make sure that the folks know how to operate the building and continue to operate it properly so that it doesn't, we don't get creep. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. White. I did have a couple of quick questions on that last building, the House of Science there. I mean, you mentioned the operations. How much does that really play into this energy savings, how people are operating their buildings?
Back when I used to teach, I used to, if you don't mind a little variance, when I started in business, we had a 1970-some Volkswagen diesel that we used as a car to run around for folks in the office. Our print boy drove it. And the dentist who lived within the office down below us had a Corvette. And, of course, that means that, you know, our Volkswagen diesel Rabbit should have be getting very good mileage, and the guy with the Corvette was getting terrible mileage. But the inverse was true. Our print boy drove our little diesel like it was a Corvette. We got about 28 miles a gallon on a car that should have gotten 46. The dentist was fearful of hurting his little car, so he feather-pedaled that thing everywhere, and he was getting about 20 miles a gallon. Operation makes a huge difference.
Okay. I did one other question was on the first page. You're talking about the 5,000 buildings that you've been doing some benchmarks on. Are those mainly public buildings that you're doing, and are they large buildings, and how many more buildings do you have yet to do? And finally, what are you going to use that information that you're gathering from those benchmarks?
Senator Solon, that's it's the B3 or the Buildings Benchmarks and Beyond project for the state of Minnesota. And working with John Carmody and Rick Carter, who you're going to hear from in a moment, and a variety of other folks. We're still in the process of both collecting and verifying data. One of the things we don't want to do is to be premature with saying what we see happening out there. These are all public buildings, It is already proving to be a very, very interesting process. It's getting more interesting as we dig a little bit deeper and start looking at the outliers, the buildings that don't use any energy or the buildings that use way more than they could, even if you left all the doors open and the lights on, and trying to find out how people think about filling out a form sometimes. And I am not in charge of that project. I am very fascinated by it because it's one of the largest long-term and I hope most accurate projects to figure out how much energy buildings really use that I am aware of, and I've been in this business for over 30 years and participated in the very first performance standards project as a technical advisor to the Housing Department of Housing and Urban Development and what was then ERDA, Energy Research and Development Administration, that's predecessor of the Department of Energy back in 76. Never wanted to go out and find out what buildings really used.
So when this concludes, about we've got another year to go, or how long before we actually can see some of this data being compiled and for public consumption?
Mr. Chair and Senators, I
believe someone else could answer.
Someone
that
here from
okay.
the Department of Commerce. Someone is here from the Department of Commerce who knows that better
okay.
than I. And
very good. Any other questions from the members of the committee? Thank you, Mr. White.
Bring up the next show.
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up,
Senator Anderson,
I'd love to get an answer to that question too. I was wondering the same thing and wishing we had it right now, so yeah. It would be nice to get a to
okay
know
if there's someone from the Department of Commerce that would have that answer.
Oh,
okay, excellent.
Do you want to?
I saw you look.
Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Janet Streff. I manage the State Energy Office in the Office of Energy Security in the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And I have been working with these gentlemen and firms since the B3 project began. And I guess I would say that there isn't a real endpoint to getting all the data. The point of the database is to allow a school district to benchmark its buildings, to continue to keep that information, and to then when they're going to be doing when they have money to spend on energy efficiency projects, to know which building to spend that money on so that they'll get the biggest bang for their buck. So although I think that we could ask the White Group to do some data mining for us and let us, you know, we could let you know which of the state buildings, you know, where they ranked the best and the worst. We can do that, but the real point of the benchmarking database is to help the individual building owners to know which buildings to help.
Okay, thank you. I was curious that some of these are, I mean, they're public buildings, and so they're going to be around for some time to come. And so I'm just, if there's areas or buildings that we need to address, are we going to be able to know which buildings those are, you know, and you know, what we should be doing to address their energy deficiencies?
There is a website, mnbenchmarking.com, that you can go and see how it's done. And then again, you know, it may be that the Capital Budget Committee would want to know where a building ranked as in the benchmarking process in, say, all the state buildings as they were asking for money to do something. You know, those kinds of things could be accomplished with this.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to make sure I understand. I think this bill only deals with new buildings or substantial renovation. Is that right, Senator Prettner-Solin?
Yes. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, this is for new buildings,
okay.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair,
It's a mandate for publicly funded mm-hmm. buildings, but it's a, you know, it's a recommendation mm-hmm. for private buildings.
And
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I think you're on the right track that I'd like to see goals like this for existing buildings, you know, for the publicly owned buildings, so starting with state buildings. We need this information so we can find out, you know, what the energy consumption is and then to figure out what the energy savings potential is in existing public buildings. And then I think as a state we need to try to set some goals for the reduction of that energy usage in existing buildings. But we need this baseline data to be able to do that. So I think that's why it would be really valuable for us.
Right.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the next bill that you're going to hear is, I think, will address some of that and we'll be requiring that the benchmarking tool be used in order to know which buildings are used. So,
I certainly think if we're going to be setting some benchmarks ourselves, the state should be addressing the buildings that it's funding, you know, with these things. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Next.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Carlson, did you have a question?
Yes,
Ms. Rapp?
I do, Mr. Chair. And what I'd like to know is how does this affect, for instance, the non-owned buildings of the state? When we go into lease agreements or something like that, do we look into the operation of those buildings also?
Ms. Draft.
This does not require leased buildings to be benchmarked. It's really for state-owned buildings at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Mr. Chair, the next speaker is Rick Carter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Carter. I'm an architect with LHB in Duluth, Minneapolis. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, and I'm the project manager for the B3 project, which includes both the public building benchmarking and the sustainable guidelines. And what I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about how this 2030 idea really translates to real buildings and give you a couple of acronyms to take away and then a couple of case studies to look at. So first of all, looking at the first slide that I have up, I'm going to talk about two acronyms. And some of you have heard this before, so I apologize for the redundancy. The first, and these are things I think you'll hear a lot more about with or without this bill. The first is energy use intensity, or EUI, which is really what this is all about. It's actually determining and measuring the energy use of a building, not just predicting it or trying to reach a certain goal, but having an actual numerical methodology. The second acronym that's buried somewhere in here is KBTU per square foot per year. Basically, that's taking all the energy use that we can measure, and today that's typically gas and electric. So we're taking therms and kilowatts and putting them into one metric and normalizing it based on size of the building and time for a year. So we can compare buildings to one another very accurately. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you three examples of buildings that were designed in the last 2 to 3 years that have been operated at least for a year or two, and show you how this would work, just sort of a comparative analysis. So the bar chart here is kind of a generic mythical one, but I have one for each example. The first column is what we would call a benchmark. In this case, it's not code, and you've heard a couple of different benchmarks today. In this case, we're talking about the typical or average building of that type in this climate, and I'll show a school, a commercial building, and a housing project. So for each of them, the average would be different. Second column is the goal, which is some percentage, and we talked about a percentage that sort of gets more aggressive over time. The third column over, I'll show you what we predicted, because we're getting really, really phenomenally well using the White Group and other methodologies of predicting. And the fourth is the actual, and that's the thing that we just really haven't done enough of, is actually measuring the outcome, the actual use of the building. So I'm going to use those metrics and talk about three examples. The first one is Quality Bicycle Products, which is a commercial project. It happens to be LEED certified. In fact, it's LEED Gold certified, which is great. But really, there was a tremendous focus on energy efficiency. So in this case, relatively speaking, we're looking at average buildings that consume about 108 units of energy. We had a goal of 65. We did a predictive model. The White Group actually did it, funded through Excel's program, SIP program, early on, predicted 47 kBTU per square foot, and after the first year of use, we measured it to be actually 42, so substantially less, in this case 60% less than the benchmark. A lot of different ways that these buildings are energy efficient. I'm just going to mention a couple of them. In this case, the primary measure to reduce energy use was daylighting. You see a couple of photographs here of a large curtain wall and a clerestory in the middle of a space. We were able to reduce artificial lighting, reduce cooling loads, and substantially reduce energy efficiency. The other thing I want to point to, each one of these slides has the colored square that talks about cost. You asked about the ability to measure the cost increases. It's a little difficult sometimes to isolate in a building what costs more, if we have more windows or if we have windows to create daylighting and we actually made the mechanical system smaller, that costs less. In this case, we have sort of an extreme example where we did a 40-kilowatt photovoltaic system on the roof. So this building generates about 5% of its power. So in this case, the power that it would use based on the average. In this case, the net energy use is the 42. In other words, the building's using a little bit more energy than that, but it's actually producing some of its own energy. So when you see the additional cost to make this building as energy efficient as it is, the $750,000, a lot of that cost was for this photovoltaic system. Even with that, given the grants and depreciation and a lot of other factors, they predict that it will save them $75,000 per year and have a simple payback of 10 years, which is about a 10% return on investment. A couple of other examples very quickly just to give you the breadth of this. The next example is a school that we did in Two Harbors that's been open for a couple of years. Not a lot of real high-tech methodologies here. One of the very energy-efficient methodologies is a system called displacement ventilation, which is a way of making buildings better ventilated and more energy efficient by putting the ventilation where it's really required, where in the occupant zone. In this case, our target or our average was 85 kBTU per square foot. You can see the goal and the model, and we've actually ended up at 54 kBTU per square foot. In this case, $240,000, as best as we can break out things that we did that you can identify as things that would actually cost more to make the building energy efficient, $50,000 a year savings and less than a five-year payback. And one of the things I want to point out, and this is just the way the world works, when we talk about simple paybacks and we calculate them the way I'm showing here, that assumes straight-line energy costs. And we know that's not going to happen. So over time, that five-year payback will actually be less, maybe by 2 or 3 years. The last example, and then I'll take questions. This was actually a bonded project. This is the Al Air Studio Apartments in St. Cloud on the VA campus. It has a geothermal heating and cooling system. In this case, we were actually able to incorporate that additional cost of $400,000 into the bonded budget for the project. We did calculate it separately. We know that we could have saved $400,000 by not doing the geothermal heating and cooling system, but given that we did, with a $50,000 a year payback, that's or $50,000 a year saving, that's an 8-year payback. In this case, the usages are quite a bit lower in a residential building. The average is around 50. Our target and our prediction were around 30, but it's actually performing at 25, so significantly less. And I predict that payback will actually be quite a bit faster. So with that, I'll stop and take questions.
Any questions from the members? Senator Sharon.
When you're talking about the additional building cost, do you have a sense of what is the percent of increase over for the cost of the building typically?
I would say, and John can poke me if I'm off here, but in looking at hundreds of buildings, I would say that the additional increases are probably between, say, 1 and 5%. They're usually pretty marginal. That's about the difference on the school project. It's a little bit higher with this building with the geothermal and a little bit more higher. The Quality Bicycle project was probably about a 8 or 9% increase, but again, that's a pretty expensive system, the photovoltaics.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much, Chairman. In a situation like this where the payback in an 8-year period is related to this is studio apartments in St. Cloud, right?
Correct.
Is this a veterans situation? Are the veterans responsible for their own heating costs here, or is that incorporated in the, I'm trying to figure out how the savings is captured then in a way that you're able to capture that savings.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my recollection here is this project was done for the St. Cloud HRA, and I believe the utilities and rent are fixed for the residents. So really what basically happens is that savings goes back to the HRA for providing services to the residents.
Senator Sharon.
And one more question, then I will pass. And I'm not sure that you can answer this, but in the course of this proposal, when we're talking about this being for public buildings, are we also talking about private buildings that might be seeking tax increment financing or other low-interest loans in order to support the project?
You can answer that.
Mr. Strom.
This is Sheldon Strom, Mr. Chairman, Senator. I think the idea is once these standards are in place and are well-established and utilities are supporting them, a local unit of government, for example, could say, if somebody wanted a slight variance in zoning, that they could then say, why don't you meet these standards? So they wouldn't necessarily be mandatory, but the idea is to make them so convenient that people could easily encourage people to follow these guidelines.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add one thing.
Mr. Carter.
From the discussion earlier, the intention of the 2030 guidelines is that as they apply to public buildings, they would also apply to substantial renovations. And part of the theory here is that between 2008 and 2030, many buildings that exist today would go through substantial renovation. So not just the new buildings that occur would be held to this standard.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, that raises another question for me. Is substantial renovation defined anywhere?
Mr. Chair?
Mr.
Not
Carter.
Not yet in this bill. So that would be part of the work of the first effort.
Because I know when I had conversations with admin about this issue, they said, you know, unless you're doing a whole, I mean, if you're just doing, you have to be like remodeling a whole wing of a building or something to be able to even, well, in that conversation, it was about to trigger existing requirements to look at renewable energy or whatever. So in order to justify the additional expense, that's just a question. Mr. Chair, can I just
Anderson.
Ask one other question?
Yes.
I thought a couple years ago, maybe last year, the year before, we passed some legislation that required state buildings to be carbon neutral going forward. Do you know anything? Maybe you're the wrong person. Mr. Carter, I don't want to put you on the spot. I wonder if anybody knows about that and what happened to that. Is that doable?
Maybe Senator Dibble has the answer.
Oh, okay. Did you work on that bill? I know it was Senator Pappas's bill.
Right,
it got merged into your bill last year, didn't
it? Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, In the Demand Efficiency Act last year, we inserted some language. I don't think it was an outright mandate that buildings, state buildings, be carbon neutral, but that they try to be.
Oh.
There's a goal, that there's an attempt that there, you know, that we move in that direction. We explore,
really like
we explore the possibilities.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, this legislation is really working towards public buildings being designed to be carbon neutral by 2030. The idea is, you know, if they're 100% emitting today, now, before, we're going to make them 50% better today, and we're going to work towards 100 between now and 2030.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I guess the appropriate question for you then, as an architect, is, I mean, can we get to carbon neutral buildings right now? And I'm assuming we can. Do you think this goal is? I mean, is it? Could we even do better than this? Do you think?
Mr. Carter. Chair, and members of the committee, John demonstrated with the Science House that we can do it today. Part of the language talks about cost effectiveness. And so given the examples that I showed, we know we can get to the point where we're keeping paybacks within what, you know, might be considered reasonable, 5 to 10 years, and get to that 50 or 60% better. Those paybacks are going to grow significantly up like this, going towards 100% better today. But that's changed so much in the last couple of years. Most people would ask me, can we get cost effectively to carbon neutral by 2030? And I would say yes. Mm-hmm. So it's not now, yes by 2030. How soon can we do it? This measure would help us get there a lot faster, I think.
That's a great idea. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I heard you mention the real world, and I think our education policy committee, we toured that Two Harbors High School. Okay. And I'm going to ask you something about how the formula might be affected, because they told us they have a swimming pool in there. But because of budget cuts, they couldn't operate their swimming pool. So this thing is sitting there with water in it. I suppose they're not really heating it. So what do you suspect the effect of that would be on that formula?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know the impact. Swimming pools can be very energy intensive, so it could make these numbers go up and, you know, possibly other numbers go down. The one of the other benchmarks that we looked at in Two Harbors was the ability to run the new building with a lower energy cost than they were running the existing building, even though the newer building is quite a bit bigger. And I don't even know if the previous building had a pool, but there is going to be a factor. I don't know what it is exactly. We actually, when we're doing the B3 public building benchmarking, we actually determine whether the buildings have a pool in them so that we can factor that in.
Thank you, Mr. Carter.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Next up, Doug Pierce. That's correct. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Douglas Pierce. I'm a practicing architect with the firm of Perkins & Will in Minneapolis. I'm here today representing the 2,000 members of the American Institute of Architects Minnesota. We're a chapter of AIA National, which has over 78,000 members across the U.S. I'm also here on behalf of my firm, Perkins & Will. We're the second largest design firm in the U.S., and in May of 2006, we became the first international firm to adopt the 2030 goals for building energy use. As architects, we believe global warming is a threat to our country's vitality and its prosperity. We also know there are economically beneficial ways to slow it, and improving building energy use can have a large impact, and it's economically effective. Oops, there we go. Buildings, both commercial and residential, are responsible for approximately 48% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. In the U.S., 39% comes from the day-to-day operation of buildings. And in 2004, AIA Minnesota was the first AIA chapter in the U.S. to draft and adopt a position on climate change. Along with calling for energy-efficient buildings, the position endorses an 80% economy-wide reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. So in 2006, AIA National followed that with a clear set of energy goals for buildings that would dramatically reduce carbon emissions from buildings and do it economically. The AIA benchmarks are the basis of the Minnesota 2030 Amendment, and AIA Minnesota fully supports the 2030 amendments to the Minnesota Sustainable Guidelines. The U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted the AIA 2030 goals in June of 2006, and similar goals are mandated for federal buildings as part of the 2007 energy bill, federal energy bill. We foresee achieving these reductions through a combination of building energy efficiency and renewable energy, with energy conservation being the backbone of the reductions. To illustrate the potential for economically reducing emissions related to building energy demand, I have a few examples of buildings designed and constructed in Minnesota over the past decade. But before I show them, I need to clarify that they are benchmarked to different standards. So when you talk to us as architects and engineers in Minnesota, you'll typically, you may hear us refer to three different basic benchmarks. One is better than Minnesota code, and that's typically reported as a percent of energy cost savings. Another common benchmark is better than ASHRAE 90.1, and that's typically utilized by LEED or leadership in energy and environmental design benchmarks. And then, as Rick talked earlier, there's better than the average on-site energy use. So the first set of examples I have are better than Minnesota code. This first example is actually just breaking ground. We're just getting it basically completed in terms of design, and the energy predictive model has been completed, and it's predicted to be 43% better than code with a 40-year savings of $15 million. And once again, these savings are in today's energy costs with no escalation. This is the University of Minnesota Molecular Cellular Biology Building. It's designed 41% better than code with a 40-year savings of 226,000 tons of CO2 and $24 million in savings, and those savings were calculated 5 years ago. This is the U of M McGuire Translational Research Facility. It's 43% better than code, 40-year savings of 117,000 plus tons of CO2, $10.5 million in savings in terms of costs. Winona State New Science Center, 42% better than code, 72,000 tons of CO2, $6.5 million savings. This is Allina headquarters in the Midtown Exchange. It's 42% better than code, 40-year savings of 65,000 tons of CO2, $5.9 million saved. This slide, the benchmarks change slightly. This is the new Wilder Center, just opened in January at University in Lexington Parkway. It's about 40 to 45% better than code with a payback of approximately 5 years. It's roughly 35% better than the national average energy efficiency for similar buildings, and it meets the current 2030 goals. This is Great River Energy's new headquarters in Maple Grove. It should operate 50 to 60% better than Minnesota code. It's about 50% better than ASHRAE and about 40% better than the national average, and the project meets the 2010 to through 2015 goals of 2030. Our nation has been energy efficient in the past, and between 1973 and 1983, the carbon emissions from buildings were flat. We did it then, and we can do it again. We have better technology now, and we have better design tools to help us predict and understand the results of what we design. As a profession, we have started dealing with global warming, and we are preparing to help lead our sector of the economy towards significant carbon reductions, but we cannot do it alone. In order to make our buildings energy efficient and carbon neutral, we will need the participation of local and state governments, the private sector, lenders, utilities, facilities managers, building users, contractors, the trades, manufacturers, and ultimately building owners need to request it, and society will need to embrace it. Thank you.
Mr. Pierce, I'm just curious, what changed in 1983 that I thought we were building more efficient homes in the last 20 years, but that trend seems to be going up. What changed then?
There were, as my understanding is, there were basically changes in building codes that relaxed sort of the requirements for energy efficiency. So, and we built more buildings, and of course, starting after 1983, buildings continue to be built, but the energy efficiency requirements were somewhat less.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from members? Senator Senjum.
I can't resist on those first three university buildings, and this is something that's a little bit in my craw, but the university seems to require one pass air on all of their laboratory buildings, air in, air out, 100%. And I don't know if you know if that's true or not, but if it were, we would see remarkable additional energy savings. I have no question about it.
The safety issues relative to labs and hospitals are, they sort of fall in the same category, are very important. And one of the things we do, as you can see with these labs, is we do heat recovery, which actually when you do one pass or two pass air, we pull a lot of the heat out of that, which makes the building substantially more efficient. So really, there's really a complex blend of life safety, health safety, and energy efficiency that's involved in making decisions relative to air changes.
I just think that needs to be studied a little more, but we won't solve that today.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Thank you, Mr. Pierce.
Thank you.
We have one final testifier today. I believe? Yes. Welcome.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Michael Noble, the Executive Director of Fresh Energy. I wanted to support the bill in front of the committee and thank Senator Prettner-Solin for bringing this idea forward. We talked quite a bit in this committee about the need to bring carbon dioxide emissions down, and what you've heard from the experts today is that buildings are a very important fraction of the total carbon dioxide emissions, and that buildings last for a very, very long time when we put them up, and that the state has a good opportunity here to demonstrate what excellence in buildings and high-performance buildings really mean. This isn't an effort to bring up the lowest-quality buildings. This is an effort to push forward the very highest-quality buildings. And having state leadership, along with the University of Minnesota, in demonstrating what these really, really great high-performance buildings, these low-energy, low-carbon buildings will look like, it really offers the opportunity to transform the entire building industry over time, because private industry will see these buildings are low cost, they're high performance, they'll get better rents, the buildings will be more durable, there'll be better worker performance in these buildings. This is a great opportunity for the state with the private industry, with the university system to really demonstrate the future of building technology, and this is a great step forward for the state. So,
thank you, Mr. Noble. Any questions? Thank you for testimony. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Yes. Mr. Chair, if there are no further questions, then I move that Senate File 2706 as amended be recommended to pass, and it needs to go to government operations.
Senator Prettner-Solin moves Senate File 2706 as amended to pass and move to state and local government operations and oversight. Any discussion or questions? Not? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, members. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here to present Senate File 3096. And there's some handouts coming around that help a little bit as well.
Six. Okay.
Madam Chair, should be in your packets the A2 amendment. It's a delete all amendment. I'd like to offer that.
Senator Dibble offers the A2 amendment. This is an author's amendment. Senator Dibble, it's an author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? That motion is before us. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What this bill seeks to do is to set up a way for local units of government to access financing in order to make energy efficiency improvements to their buildings, to their existing buildings. And it's really focused on those sorts of energy efficiency improvements that have a relatively swift, 3 to 5 year or so payback. So it would be focused on windows, HVAC systems, insulation, building envelope types of improvements. I mentioned earlier to Senator Olsen, we have other ideas moving forward, bonding, et cetera, that would help local units of government pay the incremental costs for more substantial sorts of changes to their buildings and or building new buildings to help pay for those incremental costs that would have a longer-term payback. But this has a real focus on those sorts of things, of which there are many that would have a shorter-term payoff. Some key features of the bill, Madam Chair, this is to allow local units of government to access private financing. These are not loans that are coming from public sources. The mechanism for financing is termed a lease purchase financing. And Madam Chair, lease purchase is explained in this Wells Fargo brochure that describes what lease purchase is. And in summary, it's a means of financing capital improvements that aren't bonded. It's not carried as traditional debt. The repayment comes from an annual appropriation by whichever entity is entering into the financing. You cancel the financing by just simply not appropriating and paying, although that's never happened before, but except in one case, I think. But that's a very common tool of financing. For example, schools finance purchase of bus fleets through lease purchase financing quite frequently. The state is involved by providing a guarantee that the repayment will in no way cost more, be more than the savings that are realized from the improvements through a guarantee mechanism, allowing a refinancing to occur to extend the amortization of the financing in order to lower the annual payments if it proves that those payments are coming in higher than the energy savings that are realized. In exchange for accessing this sort of financing, Madam Chair, the entities that are interested would benefit from the highest possible quality technical and financial management services that are available. I mentioned the guarantee that the energy savings would be equal to or greater than, and it, like I said, it's geared towards the quickest possible payoff. Other features, we've talked a lot about the public buildings benchmarking. The public buildings benchmarking would be one of the tools that we use in providing the technical guidance and assistance in figuring out which are the best possible improvements to be made. The technical services would be included in the financing, so that wouldn't be an upfront cost necessarily to the local units. Like I said before, there's no need to capitalize a loan fund through state sources. The state, however, does pledge to refinance so that the terms are lower than the repayments. Also, Madam Chair, I should mention that state buildings are going to have access to the same services in terms of the technical resources and the like. However, the state, that's the first part of the bill, the state isn't going to have access to this loan guarantee. It would be the state kind of guaranteeing loans to itself, which doesn't make a lot of sense. And this is a way that, you remember, we passed, of course, the conservation improvement changes last year. This fits very, very well with the utilities conservation improvement goals. And in fact, I spoke earlier with the utilities, and we're going to make sure that that's very, very clear with an amendment if, in fact, the committee sees fit to pass this proposal on to the next committee. But it's already designed to fit nicely with utilities SIP programs so that they're participating and they're reaching their new SIP goals. But we're going to make sure that that's explicitly stated.
Senator Dibble, we've inquired, and there is no other committee that wants your bill, so it will go to the floor.
Madam Chair, we have since inquired, perhaps, and did check in with Senator Anderson's committee, and because we do make use of the oil overcharged money, she feels like she needs to see it in finance. So we're on our way to finance. Madam Chair, with that, I'll just do a very quick walkthrough of the bill. I have a little cheat sheet here. The first part of the bill, and maybe I'll defer to Mr. DeFeber, who's here to help with the first part of the bill, which speaks to the state buildings, and I'll pick it up talking about the local units of government, which is very similar in many ways. So part of what he touches on, we will have already covered by the time we get to the local units. I'm less familiar with the state buildings piece.
Would you introduce yourself for the committee, please, for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy DeFebri, and I work in the Office of Energy Security in the Department of Commerce. And I can speak briefly to the state portion of this proposal. And if later you have more in-depth questions, there's a gentleman from Department of Administration who can also help out answering questions. Our approach is intended to address a number of the barriers that we find implementing these sorts of projects in state and local government buildings. Access to high-quality technical services is probably the main one at the state level, and so the most important facet of this proposal is to provide the Department of Administration with resources either to provide or to procure high-quality technical services for state-owned buildings to make assessments of what the best energy efficiency improvements are that are available within those buildings. Quite often, the people that are involved in agency work are interested in improvements, but simply do not have the capacity to make the assessments that need to be done. And so we feel that perhaps the most critical component of the state program is to be providing that technical service. We're also taking an avenue that will provide, through private financing, what we hope to be a flexible and least cost approach that is competitive with bond financing.
Okay. And Madam Chair, then the local unit piece begins on Section 4. The first part, Subdivision 1, deals with with definitions. What is an energy improvement project? What is an energy project study? Sets forward some of those conditions. Touches Subdivision 4, goes on, talks about the financing agreement, the tax-exempt lease purchase agreement. The guarantee that's referenced later is to make sure that that there's a positive budget impact to the locals that are entering into this. What kind of local units we're talking about? Counties, cities, schools, et cetera, or combinations thereof, et cetera. And then we get into the establishing the program for local units, starting with Section 5. We describe the commissioner's authority and duties. This will be conducted out of the Department of Commerce. Local units of government will be have the authority to contract with the Department of Commerce, with the technical consultants that Mr. DeFeber mentioned, and financial institutions for the financing purposes. Going on to Subdivision 2, this is a purely voluntary program, and I need to emphasize that. And all the local units of government and their trade organizations are very comfortable with this bill and are supportive and or neutral. Most are supportive. A couple are still informing themselves on the provisions of the bill, so are neutral. But it is strictly voluntary. It is going to be targeted using targeted to the B3 benchmarking tool, that database, and so there will be some ability to try to proactively identify those public buildings that have the largest savings potential. Going on to subdivision 3, talks about contracting with an expert organization, a nonprofit organization, to provide the highest quality technical services, financial management, marketing, administrative services. So the Department of Commerce would likely contract with an external entity to do that. Subdivision 4 talks about, again, targeting to local units of government using the benchmarking program. Now, it is also important, because I know there's some concern that's been articulated to me out in the hallway since this committee commenced earlier today, that somehow local units, that some, you know, the existing energy service companies, for example, will be prohibited from continuing to engage in their business. And that's not the case. Local governments can use their own technical providers, and that's just fine. They do have to meet the program criteria, however. They need to meet the thresholds and the standards that are set forth in order to access this particular source of financing. Subdivision 6 I think I'm getting ahead of myself, actually. I think that was subdivision 4. Subdivision 5, I might be getting myself mixed up between my cheat sheet and the actual draft. But anyways, subdivision 5 encourages the commissioner to promote the largest number of professionals possible out in the state to be able to assist with the technical service, the technical guidance, building capacity, so that, because there's going to be a lot to do across the entire state, and so a lot of folks need to be extremely well-trained on doing these energy project studies, et cetera. Subdivision 6 talks about the project financing and directs the commissioner to work with private financial institutions who want to offer this product, one or more, up to the commissioner. It does allow local governments, just like on the technical side, you know, they don't have to use the technical service provider that the Commerce Commissioner contracts with. They can also go and find alternative financing, so long as it meets the kind of standards that we're setting forth, that the payback is no greater than the savings that are realized. So that should also give folks out in the audience some comfort. Subdivision 7 speaks to how the guarantee is constructed. Through this financing, the commissioner is guaranteeing that there's a positive budget impact for the term of the financing agreement, so that the locals aren't paying more than they're saving, of course, and if that turns out to be the case, then offering to refinance so that the term is extended, so that the payments come down, and it calls for some methods to do that. Subdivision 8 talks about what a qualifying energy improvement project is and some of the standards that have to be determined. Has to, of course, be approved by the local unit of government, technically and economically feasible, that there are adequate provisions for the operation and maintenance of the project, that it's going to be carried out, it's going to have the positive cash flow I've mentioned, that there's money available in order to fulfill the guarantee. And this, Madam Chair, is where we're going to work with the utility companies, making sure that the local units of government are taking full advantage of the conservation improvement programs that are available from the utility company, so that we're fulfilling the spirit and goals of the bill that we passed last year. Some provisions for how we're going to provide for some of the administrative costs, and then the source of the funds that we're going to use for some of the administrative costs, as well as to be able to support the cash flow guarantee, and that's the oil overcharge money that's in subdivision 10. And I'll turn to Mr. DeFever, make sure I covered all the provisions of the bill. Anything I left out?
Mr. DeFebri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you covered it adequately. I'm sure that there'll be questions.
Okay. Right.
And Madam Chair, Sheldon Strom from the Center for Energy and Environment is here as well, either to answer questions. Time is short, so if he's available as well.
Okay. Any questions or comments? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I was on the school board, we did something similar to this. We were able to purchase, you know, lights and new motors, and there was a guarantee that the investment, the energy saved, would cover the loan.
Is that very similar to what this is?
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen. Yes, it's very similar in concept to that. I do know that, you know, something that has changed in the not too recent past is that in order to access capital, at one time school boards could bond for these resources and not have to go out for levy referendum. That waiver was lifted a few years ago, and so if school boards, school districts want to access capital through the bond markets, they have to go out on a levy referendum for these purposes. Well, you know, if a school board is going to go out for a vote on, they're going to be talking about things like buildings and, you know, things like that, and this would be, you know, understandably and appropriately so lower on the list of priorities, the things you're going to go out and ask the voters to approve and for bonding purposes. And that's been one of the barriers. I know that there was a program inside the Department of Commerce that hasn't been subscribed to as much, and I'll have Mr. DeFebri describe why that doesn't seem to do the trick either.
Mr. DeFebri.
Madam Chair, thank you. The department from 1983 until just recently operated what was the Energy Investment Loan Program under 216C.37. And we did, in the first 15 years of business, we did approximately $50 million in loans. I'd say 95% of those to school districts for energy saving improvements. In 1998, a levy without referendum authority that school districts had to repay the principal and interest on those loans was rescinded. And subsequent to that, I believe we have done $200,000 worth of business in that. And the reason for that, in part, two reasons. One is that school districts, when making decisions about what are limited resources, very often will make a decision about core needs. And regardless of how important energy efficiency is, it is not their core mission and it's not their core business. So it often has to compete and does not compete well. There are also, as we're proposing in this, other mechanisms such as tax-exempt leasing that provides them with competitive financing that they no longer need to try and access state bonding.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, on Subdivision 3 in Section 5, the primary contractor for technical financial program management services, the commissioner shall enter into a contract with the Minnesota not-for-profit organization. Is that in direct competition with for-profit? So what does the shall mean, or I get confused between shall and may.
Yeah. Senator Madam Chair, I'm fine with changing that to may if you want to make that motion, Senator Rosen. I know that's the concern that's been articulated to me out in the hallway yet today. The energy service companies think this is competing with them and I think the energy service there's a lot to do in a lot of places. I mentioned earlier that the locals can contract with any entity that they want for their technical services and still access this loan guarantee, this mechanism, or this financing guarantee. I should not use the term loan because this is not technically a loan. It's the lease purchase financing. They can access this financing at the tax-exempt rate. It just has to meet, you know, some thresholds and standards that the commissioner sets forth, you know, some sort of technical excellence to make sure that these are the best kinds of improvements to make with the shortest possible payoff, you know, with the kind of savings that are desirable. But shall, may, I'm uh, agnostic, so if you want to make that motion or I'll.
Actually, Senator Dibble, Mr. Fuller is suggesting that it doesn't authorize entering into a contract with anybody else. So he has some language that would make that possible. Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I think you'd want to say on Commissioner strike or delete shall enter may enter into a contract and delete with a Minnesota not-for-profit organization. So it would read the commissioner may enter into a contract for the delivery, and then they could enter with anybody. Otherwise, they could only may enter into with a nonprofit, if that's what your intent was.
Right. Madam Chair. Oh. And Senator Dibble, I am a co-author on this
Senator
bill.
Senator Rosen.
And I do believe in this bill, but I do also want to make sure that if there is some opposition or problems with it, that we keep it moving. So with that, I would like to offer that verbal amendment.
Right. Senator Dibble, does that with your approval?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could do this, Madam Chair. The commissioner may enter into a contract I think where people are getting hung up is not for profit, maybe with a Minnesota organization for the delivery of technical services. So we're not specifying, but we're talking about, some expertise here in Minnesota that we're looking to. That are friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And Madam Chair, we are going on to finance, so and I've committed to continuing to converse with the energy service companies that are articulating their concern.
So, Senator Dibble, I missed that. Do you?
But the commission. It would read the commissioner may enter into a contract with a Minnesota organization. Strike. So we'd strike shall and change that to may and strike not for profit.
I'm being advised that that goes against our government policy of not limiting.
Okay, that's fine. Then we'll go with the Rosen Amendment, Madam Chair.
Pardon?
We'll go with the Rosen Amendment.
We'll go with the Rosen
Amendment. I renew my motion.
Okay. Any discussion then on Senator Rosen's amendment? And that would be on line 5.25 to delete shall, put in may, and then delete with a Minnesota not-for-profit, and on the next line, organization. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion? Senator Sharon.
I just want to make sure I understand. I think that the policy is about the private relationship with government, with the private banking sector, financial institutions would be able to make a loan to a city if they want to make these improvements as long as the rate is equivalent to
a saving.
And that the payback, the promised payback in that savings should pay off that that loan or that what you're not calling a loan,
financing,
you're calling a financing.
Yeah.
And that the state's role in this is the part I want to make sure I heard you say, is that they will guarantee that portion back to the city for what is not saved. What is the state's?
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Sharon, for the opportunity to clarify. The state guarantees that the annual payment that the local unit of government needs to make is equal to or less than the savings that are realized from the energy improvements.
See.
So the energy saved, the bill that you pay, the gas bill, the electricity bill that you would have paid but for these improvements would have been greater. So you're paying less than. So you're saving money, or it's either equal or less than. And if that doesn't occur for reasons that are, that are difficult to anticipate, then the state would refinance, extend, through the resources that are made available through the oil overcharge money that we would now redirect for these purposes. So what the state would do would be to extend the terms of the financing, so extend the amortization schedule out to a sufficient length and duration so that those annual payments for the financing would come down.
Okay, I would. We have two more speakers on this bill, I would remind the committee that we have another bill to hear. We have to vacate this room at 5:30.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Dibble.
Kirk, Schneidewin from the School Boards Association did have to leave. He leaves his statement of support with me to indicate that we've been working with them all along, and they're very supportive. But Craig Johnson is here from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Okay, Craig Johnson.
Will be brief, I'm sure.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will absolutely be brief. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm here representing the League of Minnesota Cities. I was also asked to make a statement on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We're both very supportive of this legislation. It is voluntary, and it's just another tool for cities to have access to as we look for ways to be leaders both in our communities, to achieve energy efficiency in our operations, and to save money when we're looking at very rapidly rising energy costs. So we appreciate the effort. We're glad to support the bill.
Thank you. Any discussion? Okay, Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I would move that if there are no more questions or no more testifiers.
Seeing none.
Senate File 3096 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
On that motion, any questions? Then all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Okay, go ahead.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hopefully this will won't take very long at all. This is a bill relating to some of our cold weather rules, and wanted to be able to make a few adjustments that we feel are appropriate to implementation of some of these bills. And I'll go over it quickly. I do have Pam Marshall with me to answer any questions if they come up, but I'll just briefly go through it. It's not very technical in nature. So last year we passed on this bill.
Senator Dahl, maybe you want to offer your amendments
first. I'm sorry. We do have two amendments. You're correct. I have two amendments that we needed to add to this. One was
do you have them with you?
I don't know if I have the numbers with me here.
Okay.
Grabbed the wrong file. Yeah? Okay, thanks. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment. And basically what this is doing is removing Section 5.
I'm going to ask people at the back of the room, please, to close the door. We're finishing business here. And you will have an opportunity when we're finished to... So come in quickly or otherwise close the door. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm moving the A3 amendment, and this is to delete Sections 5 and 6 from the bill. We wanted to take a little more time to discuss with the stakeholders how that provision should be worded, and everyone has agreed to that, and so we'd like to remove that from the bill at this point. Basically, it's about medical emergencies. Right now, that's in place. We want to make sure that people are using it for what it's intended, and so it's a matter of working out the language there.
Okay. Then, any questions on the amendment?
I'll move the amendment.
Senator Dahl moves the amendment. So, Senator Dahl moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment passes. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, I have the A4 amendment. And what this amendment does is on page 3 of line 4, it's going to add a few extra lines onto the sentence there. If you will refer to that part of it, it... Line 3.3, it says, each utility shall use reasonable efforts to restore service within 24 hours of an accepted payment agreement. And we're going to add on that, taking into consideration customer availability, employee availability, and construction-related activity.
Okay. Any questions on that motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator
I'm just
Anderson.
I'm trying to understand what is construction-related activity. Does that mean if the workers are somewhere else in a, working on a different project, or what does that mean?
Madam Chair Senator and Dahl. Senator Anderson, yes, that has to do with you know, some of these utilities, especially when they're related to gas in the wintertime, if they have to do some things that require their construction crews to go in and reestablish service, that they may be on something. They're usually a day in advance setting their schedules. It may cause them to delay a day, be able to address that issue that they're currently on before they can get to this issue. So at the most, what I've been assured, it would extend by a day setting up, reestablishing the service. But it has to do with their construction crews.
Okay. Continues, Senator Dahl.
Thank you. I'll briefly go through the bill here. Basically, there's four parts that we're going to look at here with this bill. First is on monthly reports, which we established last year in statute. We wanted to add really one additional provision, and this is really the data that we're getting from these monthly reports is pretty useful and instructive, but we want to get it on a timely basis. So we're asking that the information be submitted within 45 days after the month end that it's being recorded for. So that's the first section here. Second section is on the cold weather rule, again, that we just amended, and basically that we're going to establish, make all reasonable efforts to reestablish service once an accepted payment agreement has been in place, giving those additional criteria. Then we want to also look at customers that are above the 50% median income rate. We know that a lot of folks are really, especially with current economic situation, that a lot of folks that are kind of on that cusp of that 50% mark in median income may be running into some financial circumstances that are making it difficult for them to reach their make these payments and other extenuating circumstances. We wanted to add into the statute that folks in that group would have the right in a payment agreement that takes into consideration the customer's financial circumstances and any other extenuating circumstances of the household, just to bring a little more clarity in setting up a payment agreement. And then finally, with regards to payment agreements, we wanted to add this particular provision that payment agreements must consider a customer's financial circumstances, any extenuating circumstances of the household, and then no additional service deposit may be charged as a consideration to continue service or to a customer who has entered into a payment agreement and is making payments on a reasonable time basis, that they can add some service charge to that provision. And those are the four elements. And if there's any questions I can't answer, I'll refer them over to Ms.
Okay,
Marshall.
And Senator Dahl, I moved you along too quickly. We didn't vote on that last amendment.
Oh.
And I think, Senator Anderson, do you still have questions about that?
Well, Madam Chair, counsel was suggesting that maybe it's kind of redundant here, saying, employee availability sounds like it's the same thing as construction-related activity, but I don't know if there's some difference there that we're not getting.
Madam Chair and
Senator Dahl.
Senator Anderson, they have different crews, and there is sometimes what I'm told is if they get to a point with shutoffs, most of the time they can do a shutoff basically by turning it, locking the box. There are times with certain things, situations where they actually have to go in and cut off the line, and it requires digging a hole. They've gone through the other avenues to try to get them to respond, and they haven't been able to. And in those situations, apparently there's last year 700 of these situations. So they have to go back in and redig a hole and get back to the line and reestablish service, which requires their construction crews to actually do that. And especially in the winter, if there's frost and things that are involved that they have to thaw out the ground, it may cause some delays that are kind of beyond their control. They assure me that they want to make every effort to get in there within that 24-hour period, but those are some of the circumstances that may cause them to have to delay.
That's fine. Madam Chair, I think it's fine.
Senator Anderson, okay.
Aye.
Any further discussion on the amendment then? This is on the A4 amendment. Then all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? That amendment was adopted. Any discussion on the bill at this point? And Ms. Marshall, do you want to say anything? Okay. Any discussion on the bill? Then Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, I move Senate File 3081 be recommended to pass as amended and move to the floor, I believe.
That is correct. Any discussion? Then on the motion that 3081 is amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the floor, all those in favor, please, did you have a question? Please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
All right. Thank you.
That brings us to the end of our agenda. We will be meeting again on Thursday promptly at 3 o'clock. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned. We finished on time.
Started 15 minutes late, so. Yeah.
Chair's bill cost us. I got a head of heart attack. So I sent over a bill here for Ellen to look at, and she said she'd send it.
But you know what I mean.
I better reconsider my bill.
How's Burmidgee?
Yeah.
Thanks for coming down.
Yeah. In anticipation of that, if we allow cities to send out a to businesses.
I said nothing.
They're busy. They said
All right.
The amount of work required for the reconnection.
Heating, annual energy use, air conditioning type and use, because some of them actually air conditioned with water. Business owned motor vehicles, miles.